The following is an excerpt from the Science Podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Finally today, I'm here with online news editor David Grimm, who's here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our daily news site, news.sciencemag.org. So, Dave, our first story deals with cutting down on illegal fishing.
Right. Carrie, fish stocks around the world are plummeting. The populations of especially some fish species are really just declining to dangerous levels. Could be very bad news for the future. And what's also bad news, or what seems to be really a contributing factor to this, is that up to a quarter of this global fish catch is actually illegal. Fishermen are taking fish that they're not supposed to be taking, mainly because these fish are endangered, and so they're further harming populations and really driving them to the brink of disappearing. This new study is all about trying to find a way to catch these illegal fishermen and really sort of stem the tide, as it were, of illegal fishing. The problem is, even if you suspect that somebody's fishing illegally or that they're catching fish they're not supposed to, it's really hard to make that determination. A lot of these fish really look very similar to each other. For example, the Northeast Atlantic cod, which is illegally harvested, looks very similar to the Eastern Baltic cod. They're highly related species. And so what's a sort of a regulator to do if they board a boat or whatever, or fishermen come into shore and they're trying to say, well, you know, did you catch something illegally? Really hard to tell.
So what do researchers propose as a way to tell the difference?
Well, what they're proposing is finding a genetic way to tell the difference. And not just a genetic way, because, you know, sequencing an entire fish could take a long time, incredibly expensive. So what they're trying to do in this new study is trying to figure out a really sort of simple, quick way to tell one fish from another. And they hit upon something that's called single nucleotide polymorphisms, or SNPs. And what SNPs are, they're basically just tiny segments of DNA that differ between populations. And this has actually been used in human beings to determine why, for example, or if, for example, some populations are more susceptible to diabetes or dementia or whatever. And why this is such a powerful approach is if you can just find a handful of SNPs that differ between species, you've got a really easy way to tell species apart rather than having to sequence their entire genomes. And so what the researchers did here is they took a bunch of endangered fish and they compared various aspects of their genome, and they were able to hone in on about 14 SNPs. Just using these 14 SNPs, they were able to, with about 98% accuracy, determine the source of 766 samples of hake. And when they sort of applied this to all the fish they were looking at, they found that they had an accuracy of about 93% to 100% in distinguishing fish that are commonly caught illegally from those that are perfectly legal to catch.
Wow. So if this technology were to become more widely available, who would be using it?
Well, this could be used by inspectors or a team of what are called fishery forensics experts that could literally be sort of sitting at European ports waiting for these fishing boats to come in and actually testing the fish. Now, it's not quite up to the speed that it really needs to be. It could still take up to 24 hours to sequence a fish or to look for these SNPs, although it's a relatively cheap process, only about $25 per fish. Obviously, you're not going to test all the fish on a boat. You'll probably do some sort of random screening. But if they can especially shrink the time this would take, inspectors could really have a powerful way of determining whether fish are being caught illegally or not.
Indeed. And in our next story, the drawbacks and payoffs to being alpha male.
Right. Carrie, we've heard it time and time again, don't get stressed out. Stress is bad for your health. It can lead to heart attacks and make you more susceptible to diseases and everything like that. Well, this new study sort of challenges that idea, at least in baboons, although it does seem to have some relevance for humans as well. The reason we tend to think that stress is bad is because a lot of studies in humans have shown a correlation. For example, there's a really famous group of studies called the Whitehall studies, which are an analysis of the British civil service, which has shown that people that are much higher rank in the civil service also tend to be less stressed out and also tend to have less incidence of disease than those who are lower rank, who tend to be more stressed out. The same hasn't actually been seen in baboons. A study that was conducted last year actually showed that baboons, which live in these pretty rigid social hierarchies, kind of akin to what you might see in the British civil service, actually the higher ranking males were the ones that were most stressed out.
And I remember that study. We actually covered that on the podcast last July. So what's new here?
Well, in this new study, Carrie, they went back to the same region, which was the Amboseli region of Kenya, where they had studied the baboons a year ago. And they didn't just look at stress levels this time. They looked at incidents of injury and recovery from injury among 166 adult male baboons. And what they found, which was kind of surprising and really contradicted the data in humans, was that the low-ranking males, which were the ones that ostensibly were under less stress in baboon society, took a lot longer to recover from their injuries, whereas the higher-ranking males recovered much faster. And you wouldn't expect that if the higher-ranking males are under more stress. That should be suppressing the immune system. That should be making them less healthy. But they actually seem to be more healthy and have a more aggressive immune system than their less stressed out counterparts. And what the researchers think is happening is that when we're comparing baboons to humans, we're kind of comparing apples to oranges, because the stress of being in the bottom of the hierarchy in the civil service may have to do with job unsatisfaction, sort of this feeling maybe of being oppressed by your superiors, whereas the stress in the alpha male baboons could be just sort of the stress of the energy these guys need to expend in order to stay competitive, to get mates. And therefore, you're dealing with different kinds of stress, and that may have different impacts on the immune system. So I think that what the bottom line of what they're saying is that you can't just sort of make this blanket statement that stress is good or bad for your health. It's really the type of stress that you're dealing with.
All right. Well, I'll look forward to hearing more about that one. So in this third story, we have an extinct technology that's being brought back on the nanoscale.
Right. Well, anyone who was alive more than 50 years ago or who owns an antique radio knows a thing or two about vacuum tubes. And these are these small little devices in old electronics. They look like small light bulbs. And they went extinct, for lack of a better word, in the 1960s and 70s. They were replaced by transistors. And the reason they sort of faded into obscurity is because they couldn't be mass produced like transistors can be. The whole point of vacuum tubes is they amplify electrical signals. They were the type of thing that could take a tiny output, like a tiny sound, and really make it blast very loudly, like you'd want to do in something like a radio. The transistors that took over for them were able to be mass-produced. They were engraved or etched in pieces of silicon that made them able to be produced much smaller, more cheaper, and they were actually a lot longer lasting than vacuum tubes. So as of the early 1970s, late 1960s, there was no need for vacuum tubes anymore. And everything, all the electronics today, from desktop computers to our television sets, rely on transistors, not on vacuum tubes. But this new study is all about vacuum tubes making a comeback of sorts. And the reason that people have been looking at vacuum tubes again, despite them sort of being gone for decades, is that they had a couple advantages over today's transistors. They could actually theoretically be a lot faster. And they're also able to withstand strong radiation. And that's been a real problem for agencies like NASA, which obviously launch a lot of electronics up into space. You've got solar radiation, radiation from space. And the concern is that you're going to be frying your components, especially if they're built with transistors that aren't resistant against radiation.
So does this new technology actually improve on these flaws in current transistors?
It does. And the way they were able to do that is to basically combine today's transistors with the vacuum tubes of yesteryear. They were able to find a way to make these vacuum tubes a lot smaller. They actually call them nano vacuum tubes. And they were able to manufacture them in a way similar to the way transistors are manufactured today, which actually makes them a lot cheaper and also enables them to be a lot smaller. And what they found is that in tests, their nanotransistors were 10 times faster than the best silicon transistors that are available today.
So these new devices are an improvement on today's transistors, but do they have any drawbacks?
They do. First of all, they haven't been fully tested. Also, they need a lot more energy to turn them on. You need about 10 volts to turn them on versus about 1 volt in modern transistors, which means that they're not compatible with today's modern circuits. You need to do a lot more engineering to make that happen. But what they do show the promise of is really saving a lot of time and money and really being resistant to this radiation, which has been a really big problem for today's transistors. So there's a huge potential there. Just need a little bit more work to get them to where they really need to be.
Right. All right. And what else have we had on the site this week?
Well, Carrie, for Science Now, we've got a story about how volcanic crystals could offer clues to future eruptions. Also a story about how pollution in Asia could impact the warming of the United States. And for Science Insider, we've got a story about the future of U.S. space policy, speaking of launching things into space. Also a story about an Italian plan to drill deep into the heart of a super volcano and whether that's a good idea. And finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, this week's Science Live is about nanomedicine, about how the science of the very tiny could revolutionize personalized medicine. And next week, our chat is about geoengineering. This is this controversial approach to essentially tinker with the planet to help curb the effects of global warming. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Great. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Carrie.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out all of our news at news.sciencemag.org, including daily stories from Science Now and science policy from Science Insider. While you're there, be sure to check out Science Live, a live chat on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.